So continuing our series of talks on the Four Noble Truths, you're probably expecting that I'll be talking about the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Fourth Noble Truth today. And you're partially right. I'll be talking about part of the Eightfold Path today, not the whole thing. We will be splitting up the Eightfold Path, and I'm going to be talking about the aspects of the Eightfold Path that are perhaps more directly relevant to the retreat practice, and Gil will be talking about the aspects of the Eightfold Path that are perhaps more more applicable and more directly relevant to our daily life practice. So I'm going to start with, I'll start with a little bit of an overview of the Eightfold Path, just a brief overview. So just as a reminder, the Eightfold Path is essentially the prescription that the Buddha recommended for opening our hearts, for understanding suffering, letting go of its cause, and coming to the realization of the cessation of suffering. And this path is, it's not an idea. It's a way of engaging in our lives, in our practice, a way of acting, intending, of being. So it's a moment-to-moment path that we walk. And if we think about this analogy of a path, path is kind of can be created as we walk it. And that's the way in which the Eightfold Path is a path. At moment to moment, we apply and open to these aspects of the Eightfold Path, which are wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. So as I just stated it, that is the what you could call the standard order in which the Eightfold Path is traditionally referred to in the Buddhist texts. And there's another way of looking at this path also from the perspective of what the Buddha sometimes calls the gradual training. Or the gradual training is kind of an acknowledgement that, you know, enlightenment doesn't happen like that. You know, that we need to cultivate qualities of heart and mind slowly over time. We turn our hearts and minds in the direction of these beautiful qualities. And it's not something that happens overnight. We can't just simply decide, I'm going to switch from these habitual patterns to doing things in this other way. We can't just choose to do that and have it happen. It's more like turning a battleship around. You know, it's a slow process. So this gradual training that the Buddha offers begins with a training in ethics to open our hearts to non-harming, to create a sense of harmony in our relationships in the world. And from that grounding of ethical conduct, ethical speech, action, we then move to cultivating our minds. And from that mental cultivation, from that place of settling down the reactivity of our minds, from the place of stabilizing our attention, and beginning to look at what is it that leads us into suffering? What is it that leads us away from suffering? To explore our minds and our hearts, we cultivate our minds using wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And once we have, in the process of cultivating our minds, wisdom develops. And so this gradual training that the Buddha offered, beginning with ethics, moving towards mental cultivation, and essentially the culmination of the path, is wisdom, which frees our heart and mind and allows us to directly realize the ending of craving, the ending of suffering. So the Eightfold Path can fit into this gradual training with the aspects of wise effort, wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood being the three aspects of ethical conduct. The mental cultivation aspect consisting of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And the wisdom aspect of the gradual training being comprised of wise understanding and wise view, wise intention. So there's these two different ways of looking at the path. One in which the aspects or the qualities of wisdom begin the path, and another in which these aspects of wisdom ends the path. So it can kind of be thought of almost as a cycle or a spiral, because it takes some wisdom, perhaps some intellectual wisdom initially, to begin to engage in the practices. And as we engage in the practices, we begin to understand for ourselves the wisdom, which then inspires us to continue further to engage in the practices, which yields more wisdom. So it can be thought of as a deepening spiral, this path that we're walking. So this afternoon, I'm going to speak about five aspects of the Eightfold Path, the mental cultivation and the wisdom aspects. So I'd like to start by talking a little bit about wise view, wise understanding, this quality of wisdom that both begins and ends. In a sense, can both be seen as beginning and ending the path. First of all, I'd like to think or explore a little bit about why view is important, why wise view is an important thing to consider. If we think about how our worldview operates, how our minds typically operate, we have some kind of a worldview that's typically given to us by our culture, by our parents, by our upbringing, by the things we've learned, by our own personal conditioning. There's some kind of view that through which we see the world. And these views can be slightly different for each of us. Some of us may tend to see the world through a filter of aversion, you know, that basically our approach to the world has a kind of an aversive flavor to it. Others of us may have a kind of a view of the world where our approach to the world kind of has a greedy flavor to it. And the aversive person may see the world, walk into a room, and immediately notice everything they don't like about the room. Whereas a greedy person may walk into the room and immediately see everything they do like about the room. So the way our mind operates is that there's almost always some kind of view through which we are experiencing our world. And that view filters. It's like seeing through a filter. It allows some things in, or that filter inclines us to see certain things in a certain way and to not see other things. So this view is really important. As Bhikkhu Bodhi put it, Our perspectives on the crucial issues of reality and value have a bearing that goes beyond mere theoretical convictions. They govern our attitudes, our actions, our whole orientation to existence. So examining what our views are, what our beliefs are, is very important. And we'll typically find that we share some kinds of views as human beings, one of which I talked about pretty extensively the other day, and that is that having things will make me happy. And we get this from not only our parents, from our own experience, but from advertisements. Here's some ad copy. So imagine this ad. There's a guy sitting on a mountain with a big Ford truck and a bunch of camping gear surrounding him. And here's what the ad says. Spence put a new twist on an old philosophy. To be one with everything, you've got to have one of everything. That's why he also has the new Ford Ranger. So he can seek wisdom on a mountaintop, take off in hot pursuit of enlightenment, and connect with Mother Earth by looking no farther than the planet's coolest four-door compact pickup. He says it gives him easy access to inner peace, which makes him one happy soul. My guess is it gives him easy access to inner peace as long as the carburetor doesn't break while he's on that mountaintop. So the view that we hold, the view that we see our experience through, is very important. And the Buddha saw that it's very important to kind of realign our view with something that's closer to what actually is happening. So from the Buddhist perspective, right view, or wise view, wise understanding, is defined in a couple of different ways in the text, and in actually several different ways. And I'd like to talk about two in particular right now. One of them is understanding, this aspect of understanding what it is that leads us towards suffering and what it is that leads us away from suffering. Essentially, what actions and qualities of mind are skillful or wholesome, which will support us letting go of suffering? And what qualities are unskillful, unwholesome, those which lead us more towards suffering? So this is an aspect of wise understanding. Understanding skillful, unskillful, wholesome, unwholesome, in particular with respect to what causes suffering to oneself or others or both. So this is not simply about looking at what causes suffering for me. It's in general, what causes suffering for the world. If how we're acting is causing harm to others, that is also considered unskillful. So this is about non-harming, about ethical conduct. And this actually was the first teaching that the Buddha gave his own son, an exploration of this. Look at your actions, look at your speech, look at what's happening in your mind. If it causes suffering either to yourself or to others or to both, you should not engage in that action, that speech, or that quality of mind. So basically, actions motivated out of greed, aversion, and delusion are those actions that tend to lead us into suffering. So this is one of the first aspects. This is the first aspect of wise understanding, to understand this, to begin to see our world through this lens of what causes harm, what causes suffering. The second way, a second way of seeing wise view is, or defining wise view, as an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. This is one of the classic definition of wise understanding. When one understands the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, in that way, the person has wise view. So, in the beginning, with these understandings, we generally need to begin from an intellectual perspective. That we kind of adopt this as a way of seeing the world, as a perspective through which to see the world. And as we engage, we begin to see more directly for ourselves the value of this. So this basic understanding, hearing the teachings about suffering, the end of suffering, the possibility for the ending of suffering, perhaps seeing how others engage with this, having a little bit of an understanding, might motivate us to take some action, to actually begin to engage in practices, in behaviors that support this understanding. This is the beginning of right intention. That from our seeing of this different perspective, our intention to act and behave becomes more in alignment with that perspective. So the understanding of what is skillful, what is unskillful, what causes harm, what leads away from harm for self, for others, for both, begins to initiate an intention towards non-harming, towards compassion, towards kindness, towards others. When we look at the view of understanding the Four Noble Truths, when we apply this to ourselves, apply this understanding of the Four Noble Truths to ourselves, and begin to see our experience through this framework, it supports this beginning of an intention to let go of the cause of suffering, to let go of our craving, to let go of our clinging. As we begin to look at our experience, directly witness our suffering, we begin to see so clearly that the direct cause of our suffering is in our own minds, and that there is some way that we can start to let go. So these aspects of these intentions that come out of these understandings are the aspects of wise intention. They're typically described in three ways. The intention towards renunciation, which we can reframe as the intention towards letting go. The intention towards letting go of craving. the intention towards kindness, and the intention towards compassion. So, as we begin to engage in these intentions from this new perspective, it begins to reshape our minds. Our minds start to ponder, to think more in line with these understandings of what's skillful, what's unskillful, what will cause harm, what will not cause harm. And a very famous saying of the Buddha: whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. If one frequently ponders upon thoughts of anger, of ill will, that becomes the inclination of the mind. If one frequently ponders upon thoughts of kindness, of compassion, that becomes the inclination of the mind. So this intention towards compassion, kindness, letting go, begins to reshape our minds. So we become, through this aspect of wise intention, we more align ourselves towards the direction of freedom, freedom from suffering. So in this inspiration, this inclination of our minds towards freedom from suffering, beginning a cultivation of our minds to really deepen this shift of perspective. Simply thinking about it isn't quite enough. That the pondering, the thinking and pondering the Buddha talks about, I think, is more than just an intellectual thinking and pondering. It's a direct seeing, a direct being with. So the aspect of mental cultivation, consisting of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, these three aspects work together. When infused with the perspective of wise understanding, they begin to shape our minds. So I'd like to go through each of these and describe each of them a little bit in more depth. So wise effort. The standard definition of wise effort is deeply connected to this different perspective, this shift of perspective towards understanding what is skillful and what is unskillful. The whole phrasing of the teaching on wise effort takes as a ground that we have some sense of what is skillful and what is unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. So there is, in the statement of wise effort, four kinds of wise effort: the efforts to avoid and abandon unwholesome states of mind, and the effort to arouse and maintain wholesome states of mind. So to just speak of each of these four, the first, the effort to avoid unwholesome states of mind. This is partly about as we explore our minds, as we come into the practices of paying attention to what's happening to us, we start to see, we start to understand some connections between things we do and the effects they have. We really begin to see in our own minds how cause and effect works. We do certain things, it leads us to suffering. So this teaching on avoiding unwholesome states is about seeing with, from our own experience, looking in our own experience, and beginning to understand through observation the causes and conditions that lead us to these unwholesome states and avoiding those conditions. So seeing that a certain set of conditions comes together to produce anger, hostility, cruelty, one learns how to avoid those conditions. This is avoiding unwholesome states. Now, there's a couple of pieces about this avoiding that I want to clarify here, because this teaching can easily be misunderstood, misconstrued. This avoiding that I'm talking about does not have an aversion to it. It's not about saying, I hate those conditions, I can't go there. So it can't have an aversion to it, because if it's using aversion to avoid, then we're essentially cultivating the aversion. And that's cultivating an unwholesome state. Cultivating the quality of wanting to get rid of, wanting to push away. So the avoiding has to become more out of compassion than aversion. And the actual meaning of avoiding also can be more subtle than you might think. So, for example, you might notice that every time you get into the presence of a particular person, there's agitation in your mind and disturbance. So you might initially think that this teaching means that you should avoid being in the presence of that person. It seems like the obvious thing. It's the person that's causing the agitation. Well, the training here is about looking at the causes and conditions in our own mind that lead to suffering, more than the causes and conditions in the world. So really this teaching is a way to engage with this particular example would be to watch really closely when you're in the company of that person and begin to understand in more detail what's happening in your own mind that's causing the agitation. Because the person themselves, that just the person, without reactivity on your part, that person has no power to manipulate your mind. They can try. They can do kinds of things. I mean, you know, brothers and sisters learn really well how to push your buttons. But if you're not responding, I mean, how many times did your mom tell you? When your brother does that, just don't pay attention. He'll get bored. So it's in our own minds that we're interested in exploring this. So this is basically a teaching on using mindfulness to understand what is it that, what are the causes and conditions in our minds. Another way to understand this teaching, particularly in terms of using mindfulness, there's a teaching called guarding the sense doors. And this teaching is often misunderstood, I think, to mean to avoid sense contact. But I think really what it's saying is to be mindful at the sense door. That the mindfulness at the sense door is really what can guard us from getting lost in craving or aversion for what we are sensing. Joseph Goldstein gives a teaching about this guarding the sense doors, and he suggests since often when we go into the dining hall, there's a lot of craving that happens. He said that he learned to just start noting seeing when he walked into the dining hall. And I tried this for myself. I had a similar experience, and having heard that from him, I tried it. And as soon as I walked into the dining hall, I just started noticing that seeing was happening, just using that as a note, seeing, seeing, seeing. And it cut the movement towards judgment, towards reactivity, to just keep the attention at the level of seeing is happening. And it felt very much like this mindfulness was this sentry or this guard protecting me from craving. So this is another way to avoid unwholesome states, using mindfulness to meet our sense experience. The second kind of wise effort is to abandon, let go of unwholesome states that have arisen. So this is basically the teaching of letting go of craving, letting go of suffering. And we've talked a lot about this in the last few days. Gil talked a lot about this yesterday. I talked about it some the other day. So I'm not going to talk much more about it right now, except to just say this is a large part of our practice, particularly this aspect of the letting be with mindfulness, letting these difficult states be as a way of allowing them to let go of themselves. The third kind of wise effort is the effort to arouse, to bring up wholesome states. And there's a couple of ways to come at this. There's essentially we can cultivate wholesome states. One way we can cultivate wholesome states is by avoiding the avoiding actions that would lead to their opposites. So that sounds maybe a little convoluted, but just as an example, the ethical training of the five precepts, refraining from killing, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from lying, each one of the precepts has a corresponding wholesome quality that is simultaneously being cultivated as you're engaging in that. So cultivating refraining from killing cultivates compassion. Acting on refraining from lying cultivates truthfulness. Acting on refraining from stealing cultivates contentment. So this is one way to look at the cultivation of wholesome, beautiful qualities. And it's a great way to engage in our training of the precepts as well. To not think of it just simply as avoiding, avoiding, avoiding. Avoiding all of these things that it can kind of feel like the Ten Commandments in this way. You know, it's like, thou shalt not. And it just feels like I've got to avoid all of these things. But actually what's happening in the avoiding of those things is we are cultivating also these beautiful qualities of mind. So in engaging in not killing the ants in your kitchen, can you think about it as an act of compassion? And in inclining the mind in that direction, it has a stronger kind of impetus towards that quality of compassion. When we bring these qualities into our minds, into consciousness as we're engaging in the training of the precepts, it has a stronger impact on the cultivation of those qualities, to make them conscious, to make it conscious. And so we a lot of the times we are engaging in ethical conduct kind of almost just as the way we are living our lives. You know, that we're not taking things that are not ours, and we're not killing beings. So to recognize that as cultivation of these wholesome, beautiful qualities. We can also cultivate wholesome qualities through an active practice of cultivating them. So for instance, so one of the kind of first ones that pops into mind is the cultivation of kindness or loving kindness through the practice of metta, through the practice of loving kindness. That the active turning of the mind towards that quality through the practice of metta, of connecting with other beings and expressing wishes of goodwill towards them, that cultivates the quality of metta. So there are active practices also towards these qualities. And if you are interested in particularly cultivating a quality of, say, patience or generosity, and being creative and thinking of ways to actively engage in that, to actively cultivate that as a practice. For myself, in cultivating patience, I find anytime there's some impatience that arises, I actively cultivate patience through turning my mind to the intention of patience, not pushing away the impatience, but actively turning towards an intention of patience and slowing down my body, kind of acting as if I were patient. Not pretending that I'm not patient, but acting as if I were patient. And I so often find that that simple movement, within a matter of a few minutes, my whole mind state has shifted. And there is the sense of patience. So creativity around these cultivating wholesome qualities. There are some specific practices for some of them, but if you have one in particular that you're interested in looking at, for me, I noticed impatience was such a big part of my mind that actively cultivating patience was a good practice for me. We can also cultivate mindfulness itself as a wholesome quality. That's a beautiful quality to arouse. My teacher in Burma, Sayadaw Upandita, said, mindfulness is the most wholesome mind state. It seems like kind of a neutral quality in some ways, but it is a very beautiful quality of mind. And the practices of what we're engaging in here are cultivating mindfulness. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. The fourth kind of right effort is the effort to sustain wholesome states that have arisen. Not by clinging to them, not by trying to hold on to them. But again, my own experience shows me that actually mindfulness of these wholesome states is one of the best ways to sustain them. Just recognize them, appreciate them when they arise. Recognize the qualities of generosity, kindness, balance of mind, of equanimity, of tranquility, of truthfulness, of patience, of wisdom, of letting go. All of these qualities, when you notice them, appreciate them. Recognize them, be mindful of them. We can also start to recognize wholesome qualities, beautiful qualities that come along in the practice that are actually happening as we practice, but we may not be actually noticing them. Some of these qualities I just mentioned. As we engage in the practice of mindfulness, confidence gets stronger, This is a beautiful quality that supports our ability to connect and engage in the practice. Interest in our experience gets stronger. Our concentration gets stronger. So actually recognizing that these qualities are being cultivated while we practice supports their further cultivation. We're so often in our engagement with our mindfulness practice, particularly if we're looking at something difficult, we're focused so much on trying to be mindful of that we're not really seeing all of these other qualities that are coming along with it. And this points to, actually, how these four right efforts can kind of be seen as four sides of a single process. So if we take this example of being mindful of anger, if we look at what is happening there, while we're being mindful of anger, this supports the letting go of the anger, the unskillful quality of anger that is already present in the mind. So that's the first wise effort. So just the being with, the mindfulness, is that letting be quality, that letting go of unwholesome states that are present currently. It's also avoiding the future arising of anger that would have arisen had you not been mindful. If you had not been mindful, the thoughts and the emotions would be kind of whipping themselves up into a stronger process. And so the mindfulness helps to avoid the arising of future anger. And while we are cultivating that mindfulness, we are simultaneously cultivating the quality of mindfulness, we're cultivating the quality of concentration, of perhaps interest, of confidence, and perhaps some wisdom, learning about how our minds work around this anger. So we are cultivating and maintaining beautiful qualities of mind. So we don't really have to think about these as being four separate things. They really can be seen as just the way that the mindfulness practice unfolds. Which brings me to wise mindfulness. And we've talked quite a bit about mindfulness too, so I'm going to keep this a little bit brief. But just as a working definition, we can define or think about mindfulness as being connecting to our present moment experience without reactivity, without judgment. So mindfulness is connected to this, what we could call a self-reflective capacity of the mind. It's just a very ordinary quality that just exists in our minds. It's not an esoteric quality, mindfulness. It's an everyday, ordinary quality that actually happens to us a lot. And what we're doing here is cultivating it, bringing it to its strength. It becomes very powerful when it is seen and cultivated and made continuous. So mindfulness has a kind of a non-interfering quality that when we are observing something, the mindfulness of it, this non-interfering quality, avoids either acting on it, and it also doesn't suppress it. So it simply allows it to be, neither trying to get rid of it or hold on to it. But it's not really enough to simply think of mindfulness or right mindfulness as being just this non-reactive attention. Non-reactive attention. It really needs to be infused with the understanding of wise view. It needs to be infused with this wisdom of the Four Noble Truths. What causes suffering? What leads to harm? What leads away from suffering? What leads away from harm? So the Buddha talks about wise attention, which is directly related to this understanding of what is skillful and unskillful, what's wholesome and unwholesome. It's related to seeing our experience in terms of what is suffering, what causes suffering, what is not suffering, and what supports that movement towards not suffering. It's really seeing our experience in this from this framework of the Four Noble Truths. So two key elements of the wise attention, if we kind of look at it in a different perspective than thinking about the Four Noble Truths, wise attention begins to understand suffering. And it begins to understand cause and effect. Exploring the cause and effect nature of our experience. How does suffering come to be? How does it end? There is one aspect of mindfulness that Gil just touched on this morning that I want to explore in a little more detail. We haven't talked about it too much. And that is recognizing mindfulness itself. Often we are, as Gil said this morning, there's the two sides of the mindfulness. There's the learning about our experience, the learning about the objects of our experience, and then there's the mindfulness itself. And we can learn how to recognize mindfulness itself. So becoming aware of what mindfulness feels like. For me, this was not an obvious thing. What does it feel like to be present? What does it feel like to be aware, to be mindful? This was not so obvious to me. But then I got the instruction to start exploring, what is it like when you wake up? What is it like? What's the difference between when you're aware and when you're not aware? To begin to explore that distinction. What's it feel like? What's the difference between awareness and not awareness? And the place for me where that exploration was most fruitful was in the moment when I remembered about mindfulness after having been lost in thought. So in that moment of remembering, see if you can recognize what it's like to now be aware. It's kind of hard to really know what it's like to not be aware. But in the moment of remembering, there's a kind of a lingering memory of what the state of mind was like when you were lost in thought. And so you can get a flavor of the difference in that moment. And getting a sense of what it feels like to be aware, to be present, begins to, at least in my experience, it begins to really point out when it happens. It actually happens a lot in our day. As I said, it's an ordinary quality. It's something that happens to us all the time. It's a part of being human that this quality of mindfulness comes into our lives. You know, we walk through a door. We know we're walking through a door. There's a self-reflective capacity. We're all familiar with it. But we tend to use it in order to think about the things that we've just become aware of. We don't stay mindful for more than a split second most of the time. We notice fuzzy caterpillar crawling on the path, and we pick it up and move it. You know, we take action on what we are mindful of, what we become aware of, rather than recognizing the quality of mindfulness itself. So the way we've learned to use this quality of the self-reflective capacity, of this ability to know what's happening while it's happening, is to basically think about the things that we become aware of. And the Buddha points to become aware of that quality itself. Get familiar with that quality itself. And as we become aware of it, we start to see that the familiarity with it begins to, we begin to recognize those quick moments that we come into that place of mindfulness. You're brushing your teeth and suddenly it's like, oh, here I am brushing my teeth. Or you're reaching for your water glass and reaching. It's like, phew, the light goes on and suddenly you're aware of it. So the familiarity with the feeling itself supports the recognition of when it happens spontaneously. And that further cultivates more and more mindfulness. It's a great practice for the in-between times, beginning to recognize the kind of spontaneous coming back into being of mindfulness and exploring what's the difference, what is it like now to be aware. So effort and mindfulness together support and cultivate concentration, right concentration. We could call a definition of, or have a definition of concentration being one of mental unification. We typically think, when we think about concentrated, we often think of focus and narrowing. But that's not so much the concentration that we're talking about here. It's much more one of mental unification, of the mind gathered together in so that all the parts of the mind are working together towards a purpose. Gill, at one point, was fond of using the term composed as a definition for concentration. The term samadhi is the term that is typically translated as concentration. And he pointed out that compose, which has a kind of a different feeling to it than concentration in our minds, composure. And actually the derivation of the term, the term samadhi, the sam part, means something like with, and the di part, or the adi part, means something like to stand or foundation. So it means something like stand with. And compose, the com part means with, and the pose part has a sense of standing. So the term actually has a similar sense to the Pali term. And that always impressed me. I like that term, compose. It has a different feeling to me in my experience than the term concentration. So there's two kinds of concentration, and this is often a place where people are a little confused. There's a one point, the most familiar kind of concentration, the one that most people think of when they think of concentration, is what's called a one-pointed kind of concentration. This is where we turn our attention to one particular thing and pretty much try to stay with that, like the breath. Our mindfulness becomes much more one of just, okay, the breath and not the breath. We don't get too detailed about it in the concentration practice. It's like, oh, not breath? Okay, come back to the breath. So that the mind begins to unify on that one thing. So it collects the mind, it gathers the mind through this effort of staying on one particular object. So the mindfulness and the effort are working together to compose the mind with the breath, for example. This produces a number of beautiful states in the mind. The hindrances, the states of sloth and torpor, of restlessness and anxiety, of doubt, of sense desire and ill will, all begin to kind of recede into the background. They're effectively suppressed through this state of concentration. So it feels very blissful to be in this kind of a state. So that's one kind of concentration. And the absorption can get very, very deep into that single object. So the mind can get very, very focused on that object such that everything else falls away. You're not even experiencing other things. It's just this kind of absorption into. The other kind of concentration is what is called momentary concentration, or moment-to-moment concentration. This is the kind of concentration that's cultivated by what we might call awareness practices, where we are more focused on, we're not focusing on a particular object, but we are allowing our attention to experience the kind of flow of changing experience. Not a single object that we're paying attention to, but rather the stream of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the endless stream of thoughts and emotions and moods arising in our minds. That just we can enter into this stream of humanity and be mindful of it. Not by focusing on any one thing in particular, but by just recognizing kind of what's the most obvious thing that's happening right here and right now. So looking at whatever is coming up in this stream of experience. The way concentration develops in this case is through a continuity of the awareness, a continuity of the mindfulness on the stream of changing experience. So it's a stability, a composure of the mind, of the awareness, to be able to be present and not pulled off by all of the changing experience that happens. So that the mind is stable, composed, and yet there's a rapidly changing series of phenomena. So it's got a very different flavor to it than the composure of what we would typically call concentration, where we're stabilizing on a single object. Again, during this process of stabilizing the mind on the stream of flow of ever-changing experience, the hindrances are suppressed. So again, we have a sense of what can be called the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of not being bombarded by the hindrances. So this concentration, the mindfulness, the effort together, they have the capacity to lead towards the seeing of, the deeper seeing of the truths that wise understanding, wise intention are pointing to. So when moment-to-moment concentration is established, the mind has the power to really clearly see into this changing flow of experience, to see its impermanent nature, to see the fact that because it's an ever-flowing impermanent nature, that there's nothing really that we can hold on to, even if we wanted to. There's nothing there really to hold on to. And that everything is ephemeral, transient, changing. There's nothing really here to be called me or mine or I. So this stability of mindfulness in this stream of experience allows us to be with these truths of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness of anything to be a lasting source of happiness, and of the fact that there's what we think of as self, what we think of as me and I, doesn't exist in the way we think of it existing. It's a process rather than a thing. The other kind of concentration, the absorptive concentration, in and of itself, you can kind of get stabilized into that absorption. But you need to bring the wisdom in order for that kind of concentration to flower into this kind of insight. And there's a couple of ways in which this absorption concentration can be used to support the development of wisdom, the development of insight. The first way, in my own experience, is that in the practice towards cultivating the states of concentration, the mind gets a really good education in causes and conditions. And what causes and conditions support this state, what causes and conditions support the hindrances, so that the mind really gets a good understanding about causes and conditions as the state is being created. And then in the state itself, in the state of just stabilized concentration, that place there may not be able to be too much wisdom that happens. But at some point, that state will fall apart because it's impermanent. And in that falling apart, the mind being pretty concentrated as the state begins to fall apart, it begins to see the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self nature of these processes in the mind. So both avenues of concentration can lead us towards this direct realization, this direct understanding of wisdom. Experientially realizing the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of cessation of suffering, through cultivating this path. So let's sit for a few moments and just allow the words to settle.